The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
My name is Phil Arendt. I teach at Schaefer Academy. Up in Rochester, Minnesota. It's nice to come from a frigid climate down to such a warm place as Atlanta. We say in Minnesota that we have 10 months of winter and 2 months of bad sledding. So that's a little bit of my, but I love it up there. Well, this talk is on the seven laws of teaching. And just out of curiosity, how many here have read John Milton Gregory's book? Excellent. So, and if you haven't, that's fine too. I'll be, you know, the whole purpose of the title is that of his seven laws of teaching, the seventh law is a law of review. So that's why I'm turning that back upon the seven laws of teaching. So, how about if we... As is the nice habit of all of our times, let me open our time in prayer and look to Him for His goodness. Thank you, Father, for this time. And I do lift up these teachers, administrators, perhaps, who are here, that you would bless them with success as you define it. Encourage them during this time. Help them, Lord. Help me to more and more reflect your goodness and your intentions to these children. Thank you for this particular time, in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I don't need to perhaps get into John Milton Gregory's bio or anything, but perhaps a lot of you know that he's a somewhat renowned 19th century educator. He even was president of a couple colleges, etc. But what we're focusing on here is perhaps his most well-known work, a small little book, The Seven Laws of Teaching. And if you haven't read it yet, I'd strongly recommend it. I've found great wealth in this. I'm in my 17th year, coming to my 18th year at Schaefer. But I've really been involved with Christian education for the past 30 or so years. And the book has meant a lot to me, and I still glean going back to it. But let's begin our time with some broad points, some broad questions. How would you respond to somebody? What's the essence of Christian education? When you see your student, you know, with all in existence that they can learn, what's the essence of a Christian education? And I would say that we teach every subject from a presupposition of how God intended existence. Every single area, and Nate Wilson touched on this beautifully, as other speakers that I've heard. Now, here comes another question. What would you say is the essence of classical education? And notice I put the word "the" in quotes, because you'd have a few different speakers perhaps answer this from a different stream that would contribute to what we call classical education. Now, I would say that a candidate to answer that would be that we teach every subject from a methodology that accommodates how students are designed to learn. Now just think about it for a minute. We talk about the pole, parrot, the pert, the poetic. We talk about grammar, logic, rhetoric. In essence, what we're doing is we're moving the student and the student's learning into this field. And we're trying to understand God's intention for their learning. Classical education goes a step further, deeper from just teaching subjects. We try to teach students how to learn. The reason we call it classical, at least in our Western culture, in essence really comes from the Greeks in some beginning point. When you picture the Greeks, as being those who cut themselves off from God's authoritative word, okay? And then they start asking all these provocative questions. Kind of know thyself, thinking of my how do I learn, what's meaning, etc., etc., etc. And then within the New Testament time, when the scriptures, the New Testament scriptures came about, it was this Greco-Roman mindset which had pervaded the listeners. This was the mindset that the New Testament scriptures were addressed to. I think it's wonderful how God's authoritative word then addressed the questions. And through the Middle Ages in the Western culture, that developed into a learning methodology, that attempted to address how students learn. And I think this is a key emphasis, and I think the emphasis is beautifully targeted by John Milton Gregory. Now, Let me say a scary thing. In this regard, I believe that every educator needs to be an adequate cognitive psychologist. You know, staring into these minds. The study of mind and mental function. You need to know about learning, memory. You need to know about attention, if you know Gregory's second law. Perception, reasoning, language, conceptual development, decision making. Gregory said, while facing your pupils, how often you wish for the power to look into their minds. That was kind of the passion or the heart, I believe, behind his emphasis. And if I could be honest, I've noticed that to be part of my passion. I go home frustrated that I can't get through to Johnny or so-and-so. And then I stew over that and I get up and I try again. Where do I touch to make him become a learner? Gregory also said, let us, like the master, carefully observe a little child that we may learn from him what education is. So let's take a look just briefly at the seven laws. I'm the kind of person who's very dependent on PowerPoint. I like schemes and pictures and diagrams, etc. I hope some of you are like that. It's how I go about life. In Gregory's words, maybe paraphrased a bit, the first law, the law of the teacher. The teacher must thoroughly know the lesson content. Make sense? No brainer? The law of the learner. The learner must attend with interest to the lesson. Gregory said it's a waste of time. Stop teaching if you don't have attention. Number three, the law of the language. The language used in the lesson must be common to teacher and learner. Okay, and we look at those three. What I would like to do is set those three aside. Because I believe that the first three laws really set the stage for teaching. You have not begun to teach yet, even though you have adequately fulfilled the three laws. These are setting the stage. Very important. First law, the teacher. You know, there might be an adult standing in that classroom with all these students. But is there a teacher in the room? What are the qualifications for a teacher? I think Doug Wilson might have talked about some so essential that you love God, that you love your students, that you love your subject. And as a result, Gregory said, you develop a copia. You develop a resource so that students begin to respect you. Mr. Arendt says, and they regard you highly as that dependable source. Not only the dependable source, but a source who cares for them. These are qualifications. If you don't have these qualifications, you cannot begin. The next qualification is the qualification of a learner. I have 20 students in front of me. but do I have any learners in front of me? So Gregory kind of bends over backwards, working on ways that we can stimulate attention and get that child's door to open to us. And I'd love to have opportunities at the end of our time for questions and comments, but these are sorts of things you should dialogue with your peers about. How do you get a child's door to open to you? Big challenge for me, especially in physics class some days. Law number three, you need a conveyor belt, a medium between you and the student. What Gregory said for law three is the teacher must come within the sphere of the child's language power. You can think of yourself as having this very large sphere compared to the students. You know what magnanimous means and et cetera, whatever words have been used. Notice that the student's sphere coming into the classroom and their language power is much larger. But I made sure on my little diagram that I had some of the sphere outside of yours. Some of the student's lingo you can exploit. The trigger words that makes them light up. Exploiting those, not only do you need to expand your language abilities, but part of learning is hopefully their sphere is going to grow as well. But here's the point. You cannot teach outside of their sphere. I don't care how much you know. You're going to have to change your language. Jesus had so many things to tell his disciples, but he'd say things like, I have more to tell you, but you can't bear them now. We have to live and speak in a medium that's within the constraints of our students' language. Lesson number four. The new content of the lesson must be learned through content already known by the learner. Your students have this resource in their minds. That's to your advantage. Exploit that. Don't teach them something they already know, but use what they know as this hook to build upon. The law of the teaching process. Excite and direct the self-activities of the learner and tell him nothing he can learn for himself. I would say that you've reached some big pinnacle with law number five. We'll talk about this more. I would even go as far as to say, if you can accomplish law number five in a classroom, everything else will come along with it. Everything else will come along with it. And this would be another opportunity for dialogue with your peers. How do you accomplish this to get a student to make something into their own? The law of the learning process, the learner must reproduce the lesson in his own mind. Now, I'd say that now you've become maybe the coach and the cheerleader, but this isn't your law in a way. This is what the student now has to get up and do. Sure, like I said, you become the cheerleader, you give opportunity, but you can't make this happen anymore. Hopefully, the student has garnered something for themselves and now will get up and do. And as I said, the law of review, the completion test and confirmation of teaching must be made by reviews. Reviews. Oops. Sorry. So lesson number four is, or lesson, law number four is really the lesson content. Okay? Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon in, what was it, 49 B.C. It's what we're learning today. How can I get this item of learning across best to my students is law number four. Now, law number five, which I put a lot of emphasis on just a moment ago, I think is the pinnacle because now this, I believe, is your goal. you know, you have steps along the way, but your goal is to take from them knowing the lesson, right? Getting an A on the test, that's law number four. They finish law number, they can get the A on the test, and then it's gone out of the mind the next day. How can you make the lesson theirs? That's law number five. And if I could say, these lessons have to get beyond the mind, and they have to get into the heart of the student. And it's such a beautiful thing in classical education, because I believe the step from law four to law five, can everyone hear me okay? I hear my voice changing. The step from law four to law five is really a hallmark, I believe, of classical education. So often education stops with delivery of content reproduced by the student on the test, and we go on to the next chapter. No, no, that's not your goal. That's a long and so vital towards your goal, but our goal really is to the heart. And I think that Western culture and through medieval times and the development of this saw a beautiful need in that area. In Law 6, now we get to the student. The student now needs to do. The student now needs to become the teacher. What opportunities do you grant your students to get up and do, to get up and be the teacher, to get up and perform? I think that's so vital, and we'll talk more about it. Notice in the seven laws, we have some catchwords: no, interest, common, known, excite, reproduce, review. Tom Garfield came up with the acronym KICKER to help help you remember, maybe, the seven laws. Now, I think acronyms are very, very important. But I have to admit, seven laws for me is a hard thing to... Is it four? Is it five? So, let's review the seven laws from a different angle. Gregory said that a review is more than a repetition. It involves, I love this, fresh conceptions and new associations. Okay, class, we're going to review Newton's law now. Newton's first law, blah, blah, blah. Gregory, that's fine, but Gregory said you really want to make an impactful review? Try to come at it differently. See what happens. Now, I found great benefit of a perspective back in 1988, I can remember the day, I worked as a chemist, industrial chemist, and I was on my lunch break. I had my Bible open to Romans chapter 10, and I read verse 14. I don't know if it ever happened to you, but it just leapt off the page. If you recall, it says, "How can they call on him in whom they have not believed? How will they believe in him whom they have not heard? And how will they hear without a preacher?" What immediately struck my attention was the rhetorical statement. How can they? In essence, Paul was saying, unless you have this, you cannot do that. Unless you have believing, you cannot call upon. Unless you adequately hear and understand what's being said, you cannot believe. Unless you have a clear preacher, you can't even hear and understand. The preacher, then the hearing, then the believing, then the calling upon. The preacher, then the hearing, then the believing, then the calling upon. And what I had was a picture that's a little more simple for me than seven laws. I pictured my student's mind, and I put the mind into four quadrants, with the preacher being in the first, the hearing the second, the believing the third, and the calling upon being in the fourth. I did have a handout available. I don't know how many were there. I just selected, I picked a few slides. You know, it'd be crazy to give you all of them. since I just interrupted myself, if any of you, if this is helpful, what we go through, and you would like the PowerPoint slides, I'd be glad to email those to you. So just request that my email. So, my student in front of me, here comes my lesson, must adequately receive. They must hear. They must know. They must identify properly, understand. They must value, become endeared. It must become a part of them. And they must respond. They need to get it in. They need to get it. They need to want it. They need to do it. Or else there's something inadequate in their learning. And this is a goal that I have, and I try to revolve my teaching around this expectation. Someone reaching out to receive, not drop the ball, studying it, becoming endeared to it, and then walking with it, was a foursome that I could not let go of. I know that Romans 10:14 is talking about the gospel. How beautiful are the feet of them that bring good news. But my mind could not let go of the greater application significance of our holding on and responding to anything in God's existence. The mind and heart distinction, I think, is a helpful one, because a classical educator needs to get lessons into students' minds, but again, our target is their heart, is their wants, is their values. We see this, I just put a few scriptures there. We also believe, you know, therefore we speak, we call upon. Have you received the Spirit by the works of the law, or did you receive by hearing with faith? Now, what's preached to them, it wasn't a benefit. That what they heard wasn't profit because it was not united with faith. Your students are hearing a lot. Is it going to profit them? No, unless they unite it with faith, trust, becoming endeared to, cling to. They want to promote it. These laws of Gregory, he said, are really the laws of the mind. So let's take a look at Gregory's seven laws with respect to this different avenue of these quadrants that have been helpful for me in my teaching. It's my proposal that his first three laws all deal with adequately helping the student get the door open so that I can connect with the student. Isn't that interesting that in my perspective, Gregory took three, half of his first six laws and devoted them to just getting your student on the edge of their chair? Nothing has been shared yet, but their drool is dripping on their paper. Is that overkill? Maybe that's overkill. In physics class, that's overkill. So anyhow, I teach chemistry and physics and apologetics doctrine, so wear many hats. But I usually talk about physics, so anyhow. It's very interesting, those of you who are familiar with Aristotle's On Rhetoric, his three modes of persuasion, the ethos, pathos, and logos, really mirror well Gregory's first three laws, and that the ethos, that's the source credibility, that's you, that you need to have good ethos. So that, again, the student can have confidence in you. They can feel comfortable with you. They know that they're loved by you and cared for. And I tell my students, I love you so much, some of you aren't going to like me. You know, that's what love does sometimes. The pathos, again, trying to get their attention, trying to salt the oats, trying some way for them to say, if I can get a student to say, cool, you know, I know that the pathos, that persuasion is working to creak open that door of that student who just has this smirk on their face. And then the logos, making sure that there is a well-understood channel between us. And I'm using words that they know, you know. These are words that are really familiar. Now, whereas Gregory emphasized these manners of persuasion of data reception, I'd like to bring along another figure who I think has been very influential, though I have big disagreements with him, and that's John Locke. John Locke emphasized not as much the persuasion of this reception, but the prerequisites. What this sort of reception channel needs to have at its foundation. In other words, what features must be satisfied for the environment to become an actual proclamation, that my voice becomes something that actually gets to their ears? And what Locke gave were three prerequisites for optimal reception. And I found these so simple, but yet so profound, that they kind of create a tidal wave right through our reasoning. First of all, for a student to be able to take something into their mind, there has to be some distinction, some notice of apartness. Locke said, unless the mind had a distinct perception of different objects and their qualities, it would be capable of very little knowledge. Notice my great artwork there of you're separating two things. Next, Locke said, composition. Not only do we have to notice a partness, we have to notice the parts, that it's a complex item that we're trying to bring into my thinking. He said the next operation we may observe in the mind about its ideas is composition, whereby its parts together, several of those simple ones it has received from sensation and reflection, and combines them into complex ones. I see the parts. And the last is relation. We notice likenesses. It seems to me to be the prerogative of human understanding when it has sufficiently distinguished any ideas, set them apart, so as to perceive them as perfectly different, and so consequently, too, to cast about and consider in what circumstances they are capable to be compared. So in the first case, I see on my messy desk a stapler. I've noticed the stapler. It has been set apart and distinguished. I can't notice a stapler until I first set it apart as different than anything else. Then I notice the hinge, I notice the, I see what that thing is. And then I notice it in relation to others. It's kind of hinged like a one-hole punch. And your mind does this just instantaneously. But I thought that Locke was ingenious how he put these together. These weren't novel, by the way, in his day. I just like his wordage. Luther said, don't your rhetoricians teach that he who undertakes to speak upon any subject ought to first show whether it exists, and then what it is, what its parts are, what is contrary to it, connected with it, and like unto it, etc. So let's proceed on. It's my conviction that John Milton Gregory's fourth law coincides well with what I would consider the second quadrant of the soul of this student I'm looking at. This is a law of the lesson. New content, we said, of the lesson must be learned through the content already known by the learner. So we transition from receiving to identifying or knowing. Here's my proposal. I propose that knowing the lesson must develop in a manner that is derivative to reception of the lesson. Student thinking, this is in the lesson, takes its cue from how the data is noticed. Locke said, the whole extent of our knowledge or imagination reaches not beyond our own ideas limited to our ways of perception. Whereas receiving begins with some manner of open door proclamation to the student, a lesson begins with some manner of proposition. Again, here's our lesson. Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon in 49 BC. That's what we're learning today. That's the proposition. Now, maybe some of you know where I'm going with this, but I believe that this mind's knowing derivative from its receiving, if the distinction, composition, relation providing contrast, providing the pieces, providing similarities. Gregory said that the proper exercise of the intellectual powers, listen to this, is found in the acquisition, the elaboration, and the application of knowledge. The acquisition, the elaboration, and the application of knowledge. Let's pit these two gentlemen, you know, side to side here. We need to get the topic in place for their memory so that they know, so that they know about Julius Caesar and the Rubicon. They've abstracted it, they predicated it. It's knowledge, it's in their memory. That's just the beginning. We need to understand the interplay. Okay, Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon. What does this have to do with where it fits into the scheme of things in that era? Was this in Roman law? Was that legal for him to do that? Is there going to be a stir-up of some factions as a result? We're starting with our puzzle piece, and we're starting to connect other puzzle pieces to it to find how it fits, what its significance is. And then we find extensions to that. If Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon, what do you think could possibly happen? And take our student into hypotheticals. Notice again how this is sort of derivative of distinction, trying to get it set in place as a distinct, you know, proposition. Composition, trying to find the parts that are involved with this event. Then relation, trying to draw lines out to what kind of consequences could come from this. Maybe you already see how the grammar, logic, rhetoric is a beautiful development of even Locke's perception of student learning. Now, you can take this backwards also. Sure, we start our lessons with a proposition that we want to teach our students. But I suggest that you might backtrack. You might backtrack and start nudging their reception. Start nudging their first quadrant with distinctions, compositions, and relations. Distinctions, the Rubicon, what kind of river was that? Were there any other rivers that were different? What about Julius Caesar? What kind of a leader was he? Was it different than other leaders? And you can, you know, compositions or the parts that are playing in this relation, what are some similarities between these? I think are very, very helpful. Acquisition, elaboration, application. I consider acquisition, I call it the student's categorical thinking. This is the knowledge, the grammar of the mind. This is the memory. This is putting it in place, finding a place. Remember, you exploit the old and teach the new, using the old of what they know. Finding a place within memory and working hard that they get these facts into memory. But let's continue. Elaboration is your dialectical thinking. The dialectic is a very turbulent affair. When you wrestle with all the integration of all the interrelated pieces that are really pertinent to this point. This is the understanding. This is the dialectic of the mind. The application is what I call hypothetical thinking, the causality, what could possibly happen. And this is really wisdom. Wisdom looks down the road and sees from what I'm doing right now, what could possibly happen? Or looks into the past and what brought me to the blessing or the jam that I'm in right now. Knowledge is what's sometimes called declarative knowledge. Understanding is procedural knowledge, and wisdom, sometimes called conditional knowledge. It is, it does, it could. Regarding hypothetical thinking, this is really critical, I believe, especially for middle school and up. I had a teacher years ago. She taught seventh grade. And she finally told me, I will not allow a what-if question again in my classroom. What if this happens? What if that? Well, granted, questions like that can derail your time, but just wait a minute. In my class, if I have a well-thought-out and pertinent, it's not a smokescreen, pertinent what-if question, do you realize what the students are saying? I even tell them, if anybody in here says something like, Mr. Arendt, if that's the case, then what about this? I'll get out my grade book. I'll put a star next to their name. I don't know if you call it extra credit or whatever. But that student is thinking hypothetically. On my chemistry tests, I give a question for honors, and I call it hypothetical. So now that they know all these things, I do it to them. What do you think would happen here if I would mix this and this together? You know, what are the possibilities from what you know? That's the big picture of rhetoric. You all know your formal classes of logic class and rhetoric class. Now, my conception of the grand definition of rhetoric is the impact something has. The trying to persuade and have impact and reach out in extension-wise from the thinking that I've done in the dialectic. Gregory said, it is an evident advance over the memorizing of words. Okay, that's categorical thinking. That's good that students become skilled in memorizing. When the pupil has also this integrative, this understanding of the thought. Can we go any higher? Yes, indeed. A still higher and more fruitful stage of learning, Gregory says, is found in the study of the uses and applications of knowledge. And again, that's a hypothetical thinking. We're still in just the second quadrant, but this is high-level thinking for students. If I could get a third grader to think this way, he or she is on a road to some great things. It's the out-of-box sort of thinking that I believe we all should foster. We should make some righteous rebels, or whatever you call it, out of some of our children. Knowledge, understanding, and wisdom is sometimes called the theological trivium. I won't go through the verses, but there's so many. I just listed a few in Proverbs, Isaiah, Colossians. Needless to say, you see these three steps linked together quite often in God's Word. So let's go on to Law 5. This is your goal. This is your telos as a teacher. This is what you, again, if you can accomplish, oh my goodness, do you ever have a learner on your hands? Because I believe if you can accomplish in this area and get a love of learning accomplished, the next quadrant, you know, them doing it, it's like downhill. So you've worked to get uphill all this way, perhaps. You excite and direct the self-activities of the learner and tell him nothing that he can learn himself. So we're going from the mind to the heart now. We're going from knowing or identifying or the lesson itself to the heart now, to the wanting. Okay, here comes my proposal. It's my proposal that the student's heart must develop in a manner that is analogous, derivative, here we go again, of the student's mind. Whereas receiving begins with some manner of proclamation, knowing, identifying, begins with some manner of proposition. Think about this. Please think about this. Wanting begins with some manner of promise. And some of you maybe already know how God takes your heart at times when you're hurting, when you're perhaps not on task, whatever. And he brings a promise to mind. I'll never leave you or forsake you. I've given to you everything pertaining to, you know, righteousness. So, let's follow what we've established. I believe that our students should be involved in categorical valuing, dialectical valuing and hypothetical valuing. It's very simple. But I think starting with Gregory and some of Locke's help in my thinking, I believe it fits so well. Categorical valuing is establishing a hope. A hope that that there is meaning in the universe. A hope that there is love. A hope that there is a purpose for me. A hope that I'm valuable. You see, all this hinges around promise. This is the rock of all of our lives, and we need to teach the students that it's the rock of their life. Not only that, but there is dialectical valuing. This is what we call faith. Now notice, up in the mind, what's understanding? Understanding is realizing how knowledge works, how it fits, right? But what's faith? Faith is realizing how a hope works. I subjectify it. Everyone has their own measure of faith. I subjectify it to my own life, to my own heart. Are your students subjectifying that and realizing that the value behind every subject that you teach is for them? The application, I find hypothetical valuing as love. It's rhetoric of the heart. This is when you reach out and you take something and you promote it because it is, you are cared for and you want it to be an item of blessing to someone else. So categorical valuing, hope, if we could peel it apart just a little bit, the steady undercurrent of God's promise within every lesson. In math and science, God has intended temporal design for glory and habitability. History and social studies, God has intended his purposes to be fulfilled through the choices of mankind. Art and literature, God has intended his purposes to be displayed by human expression and propositional language. Theology and Bible, God has intended his purposes to be displayed by divine propositional language. If we subjectify that then to each individual heart, we subjectify the promise value as appropriate for my needs. What can it do for me? Can this hope satisfy a need or solve a problem? I get this in physics class. Do you know what I'm going to say? What good is this? When will I ever use this? And even though, again, there's an attitude that might be attempting to cloud the issue, it's important to address that. Because if I could see a right attitude behind that, what I'm seeing is a young man or young woman who wants to add faith to their knowledge. They want to have a place personally with their needs. They want to have their needs and a place within what's being learned. And I've tried, it's a slow-moving train, but I've tried to work at my lessons to try to address how these lessons have a bigger picture behind them. It's called God's intention for you. Gregory said, find the relation of lesson to the lives of the learners. Its practical value lies in these relations. Select lessons which relate to the environment and the deeds of the pupil. Find relationship there. As far as hypothetical valuing, I become endeared to the lesson and promote it to others. Jesus said, freely you've received. Wow. Freely now give. Gregory again said, the time may well come when respect for knowledge, because it's useful, the utilitarian side, which is important, becomes a real love of knowledge for its own sake. This faith, hope, and love is often called the theological virtues. Again, numerous times in Scripture we see those linked together. I wonder why. But now faith, hope, and love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love. I think saying that doesn't diminish the other two, but from what I can see, love is the telos, it's the target. You just don't get satisfied, right, and keep it to yourself. You don't get satisfied by God's goodness and keep it to yourself. We have a telos involved here. And lastly, law six. The law of the learning process fits well in our fourth quadrant of responding. Remember, we get it in, we get it, we want it. And now it's downhill. If you give opportunity for it to go downhill, we do it. I'm involved with science fair in the Rochester School District, and it's nice to have students get up and do it, do their own experiments, and tell judges about their accomplishments. The learner must reproduce the lesson in his own mind. You have a proclamation, you have a proposition, you have a promise. Responding begins with some manner of predicament. Do you like how I did all the P's on that? I usually don't do that, but I know somebody in here likes that, so I just thought I would. Responding begins with a predicament. We just don't respond into a vacuum. We always respond to, towards something. Now the student has to become skilled in exporting acquisitions. This is a categorical response, a dialectical response, a hypothetical response. They have to garner and be able to store adequate knowledge, the copia. And we work and we work and we work. I'm aghast at some of the speakers here at this conference and the copia. You know, I have that fall out the other side of my head phenomenon, but it's just phenomenal how much a brain can retain. But are they skilled in the dialectic and solving problems? Are they skilled in implementing change? Here's your rhetoric. Can they stand up and be persuasive to implement change? Can they uncover what's the true predicament here? How does that predicament actually work? You people are seeing this wrong. And how can I inspire remedy for that predicament? Now, that fourth quadrant has some impact. And here's the point. If I can get my physics students enthralled with their science fair and things just go wonderfully, I find out something about how responsive and alert they are in class. They begin practice things and they end up discerning better. Isn't that interesting? It says, but solid food is for the mature who, because of practice, have their senses trained to discern good and evil. If any man, Jesus says, is willing to do his will, the Father's, hey, you're going to know. The Pharisees were after Jesus. They don't understand what he's talking about. He said, if you're willing to do it, the door is going to open. I can remember the story of Ann Sullivan, the teacher of Helen Keller, struggling with this young girl, trying to get her to learn. And what Ann Sullivan said is, once I got Helen to do what she knew, the doorway for her learning opened up. It's like a constipated mind. You got to begin exercising. Gregory said, we master truth by expressing it. So you see almost a cycle here, that by doing, the doorway gets open even more. So you can consider that another avenue of getting students to open the door. You think of hands-on learning, get their hands on what they're involved with. This is my perspective. I wanted to offer, if this has been helpful, I have written a book, The Quadrants of the Soul, A Classical Paradigm of Christian Understanding, in which I took this perspective and I dug more into Western culture and into scripture, and it is available at the Eighth Day book table if you're interested. Again, as well, I have my email there if you would like the PowerPoint. If this is helpful and you'd like to stew a little bit more in how to implement some of Gregory's wonderful laws into your teaching repertoire, again, it's a slow-moving train. Each year I grow. Please email me, and I'll be glad to send that to you. I even have my thumb drive here if you want it right now, but whatever. What time is it? Do we have time for any... It's 4. What time are we supposed to finish? 4:10? Something like that. Are there any comments or questions? I do better if you give comments than questions. No. Anything. Yes, speak up. Well, the seventh law is basically, again, the law of review. So the seventh law takes another circle around, basically, is how I see that within the quadrants. Really, you have the six laws of learning. And the seventh law is keep at it from another angle. Keep at it from another angle. You know, I've tried to read a lot, and there are others, you know, who have different approaches than this quadrants approach, which I find very helpful. I've found threefold approaches, fivefold approaches. Don't read Kant. He has a 12-fold approach. It's horrible. But anyhow, any other comments or questions? Well, great. Thank you very much. Thank you.